Good morning, everybody. Looking forward to a great conversation with another employer. We've done a series of these and we'll share the archive. So the great thing is, there's really a bunch of good news that I want to share. One of which is what we're going to talk about is working in every corner of the country, large organizations, small organizations, public sector organizations, private sector, rural and urban, large and small, you name it. But it's very helpful to hear about specific examples. And so I'm just going to provide a brief introduction. There's a lot of people registered, some new, and we're fundamentally about empowering community-owned health plans. We define community broadly. You know, community can be an employer, could be a union, ultimately probably a place-based thing. And you know, my last book was entitled Relocalizing Health. And one of the things that's interesting is that if all the employers did what we're going to hear about today, this would be like a recurring $500 billion economic stimulus every year. You know, people don't tend to think about healthcare when they think shop local. You know, they think of retail or food or something like that. But what's more local than an interaction between a doctor and a patient? And you take a county like the one I live in, where, you know, about a quarter million people, so all in, all ages, we've probably spent about $2.5 billion on healthcare. At least a billion of that is extracted out of our local economy for a fundamentally local service. It's essentially a tax we never voted on by Wall Street. And so it's straightforward to get rid of that. The good news is, I mean, I had to highlight three pieces of good news. One is we're already investing more than enough money to not only fund a world-class healthcare system, but to fund or restore funding for what actually drives 80% of health outcomes, which is not the sick care system. It's having, you know, career and job opportunities and decent pay. It's educational opportunities. It's being able to live in a decent home in a safe neighborhood. These are the things that actually drive health outcomes more than anything else. Sadly, healthcare is stolen away from that, so we fix that. Second piece of good news, healthcare isn't expensive, despite what you've heard. After all, clinicians only get 27 cents of every dollar we ostensibly spend on healthcare. If you get rid of that other gunk, you know, a little bit of it's necessary. Obviously, we need to have structures and all that. But again, across all the clinicians, there's 6 million clinicians, they're only receiving 27 cents of every dollar. And so healthcare is not expensive. We just want to pay for health, great healthcare, not a lot of other things. And then, as I alluded to, the third piece of good news is healthcare is already fixed. Every solution that has been needed to the many problems has already been invented. It's already been proven. It's already been modestly replicated. So it's both a true and aspirational statement. Of course, it's not mainstream yet. That's what we're all about. I want to jump in. What we're about, why we exist is what we call the Health Rosetta Dividend. It goes back to that $1 trillion that we're wasting every year. That would be the 15th biggest economy in the world, that $1 trillion that is well documented we waste. What we do is stop that, and then it can get reinvested into the things that I mentioned. I have some examples here, and there's all kinds of spillover impacts that happen inside for the individual employee, for the employer, and then the broader community. And that's just on the dollars and cents side. And then on the health side, when you have the right kind of health plan in place, rather than the status quo, which has given us record levels of bankruptcy driven by medical bills, it's given us the opioid crisis, it's given us the rising benzos crisis, it's given us preventable medical mistakes as a third leading cause of death. When you actually pay for great care and steward people through the right places, if you could package that in a pill, it would be the blockbuster drug of the century. It's that kind of impact. So that's what we're really about, is freeing up those dollars so they can actually go to health and well-being. And on the back of my book, Relocalizing Health, we have this five-step plan. A lot of people think fixing healthcare is like trying to fix Middle East peace. Like it's like they'd like that fixed too, but it seems kind of impossible and out of their control. We make it clear there's five steps. Four of the five steps are either invisible to the member or clearly a positive. it's only the fifth one that if it's not in the hands of a professional that you can have blowback. And so I'm going to just step through those real quickly. They spell out local, you know, appropriately so, given that we want to relocalize health. And the questions that I'm going to ask Michaela and Ben, whom I'm going to introduce in a minute, will follow this framework and these steps. And we don't necessarily expect everybody to do all these steps right away. So it's always interesting to hear how people go through that journey. But I just wanted to set a little context. You know, the old school model of, you know, come up with some health plan, and then there's supposed to be this big bang theory where you get the benefit. Sometimes that doesn't happen. We believe in more of a step-stair approach. You know, step one, learn how to be liberated from the status quo. That's what this call is about. Hundreds of employers all over have shown the way. And it's just a mindset shift. Once you understand that healthcare is very fixable, then it's straightforward to do it. And of course, the status quo wants you to think it's complex and impossible. And it's not that you don't have to be thoughtful about it, but the folks that have been doing it for years, in some cases like Rosen for 25 years, they're not yet the mainstream. That's what we're all about, is bringing that. So that's step one. You get some benefit from that. But then step two is, maybe it's boring stuff, but it's very foundational. It's kind of the master key that unlocks the other doors. It's optimized plan infrastructure. It's working with the right kind of benefits advisor that you have aligned interests. People always ask me, where do I start? That's where we start. That's why that's the tip of the spear. We have a plan sponsor bill of rights, an advisor code of conduct that all advisors in our program sign up for, and advisor compensation disclosure form. These are kind of motherhood and apple pie type of things for those of us who are relatively new to benefits, some, you know, in my case, you know, 5-7 years ago. Unfortunately, it's a perfect polar opposite to what the status quo is. So we fix that. Employers like a copper state, they didn't actually, at their first step, they didn't change anything about their plan, their network, their primary care, any of that. And just by kind of getting rid of junk fees and, you know, kind of watching things, they achieved $1,000 per employee per year of savings. You know, that was $1 million for them. That was a, you know, 1,000-person organization. So there's a bit of savings here, but again, it's kind of the master key that unlocks the other doors, because sometimes you're prevented in doing things contractually. Unfortunately, contracting norms in our industry have normalized deviance. So you have to do a reset. And so you get some benefit there. But then now let's get into the care part. The lowest hanging fruit is pharmacy. You know, some of the largest companies in the entire world are companies that are in a category of people that most normal people have never heard of, called like PBMs. And there's so many shenanigans going on there that it's a very straightforward fix. You know, at a large scale, you know, state in New Jersey, over the first 3 years of their fix, they got $1.6 billion of savings with a B for their state employee health plan. Caterpillar, you know, they understand supply chain. They took it on. They basically, you know, did that. They haven't seen overall healthcare spending for their organization go up in over a decade just because of how diligent they've been in pharmacy. Pacific Steel, I'll mention later, about a quarter of their savings went in pharmacy. So you can typically, within that bucket, could save 20, 30, even 50% of off what you're spending. And so overall, that's can be a 5 to 10%. And that's without having to change the formulary, which Caterpillar did, by the way, or change where you get medications from. So there's additional opportunities there. But again, the member, maybe the only thing they notice is they no longer have cost sharing, because once you're smart about procuring drugs, you can waive cost sharing, you know, when people go to the right place. So definitely some benefit that can then fund probably the first thing that the member can notice: proper primary care. There's no well-functioning healthcare system in the world not built on proper primary care. Unfortunately, we've systematically destroyed primary care in this country over the last couple decades. It's not rocket science to rebuild it. We're doing that brick by brick. If you look at the organizations that have saved the most money for the longest amount of time, the Rosens of the world, the Gasparillas, and they're spending literally half of what a typical employer is spending, that's at the root of it. It also is kind of a master key that unlocks another door. There's some savings there. Of course, you can't price gouge on an ER visit that never happened. Half of ER visits are not actually emergencies. when you have proper primary care, 90% of the issues people enter the healthcare system for can be fully addressed in a proper primary care setting. That's again, not the norm. That's what we're working to reestablish. And you can't price gouge on a surgery, inappropriate surgery that never happened. You know that 90% of spinal procedures would be more positively impacted by physical therapy. These type of things are where some of the savings come. And then when you have a complex medical issue, it's great to have a primary care doc to kind of, you know, when the medical C's get choppy, you want a seasoned C captain. They're really helpful. I've personally experienced that with my dad's 5-year Parkinson's journey. It just made all the difference in the world. And then the final step is where, again, you have to be thoughtful on this. This is where the best bang for the buck is, but also it's the most fraught if you go in just willy-nilly. Some people do that and there can be blowback. The smart folks, the Pacific Steels, you know, they were spending over $8 million about 5 years ago on health benefits for their 700 employees. Now they're spending, after 4 years, they went to $3.5 million, actually under 3.5. I just had a call with them this week. It went up to $3.6 million. Why was that? Well, trend, by the way, had they kept on the trend, they would have been spending $9.4 million. Well, like any organization, they're going to have cancers. They had a bunch of cancers. They had somebody with a very serious heart condition, ultimately passed away. These are normal things that happen. You know, as a general rule of thumb, 4 out of 5 years when you go self-funding, you're going to come out ahead. And then probably 1 out of 5 years, you're going to have a bad year. So you got to have right proper risk management so that that covers that issue. And that's what they do. And so those are the typical steps that we see. And you realize all this incremental benefit versus kind of the wait, and supposedly have the payoff. And so that's a little context. I want to get in and introduce Michaela Plotner, who's the director of HR for Horizon Goodwill and the benefits advisor that she has been working with. Ben Pohanowitz, who's out of Maryland. And so I'm going to stop my screen share here. And why don't we just start off with a little background? I know that Ben has actually been working longer with Horizon Goodwill in a way than Michaela has. So maybe we'll start there, Ben. You can set a little bit of context of a little of the history, and then fast forward it, and then pass the baton to Michaela to describe kind of, you know, what's happened recently, and, you know, just give a little bit of information on the organization, the size of plan, eligible employers, kind of what had happened in terms of rate increases, and then bring it forward, you know, a little bit to today, and then I'm going to ask you some questions kind of in that local framework that I mentioned earlier. So why don't we go there?
Awesome. Thanks, Dave. Well, Horizon Goodwill is a nonprofit. Health benefits represent a very large portion of their overall budget, like it does for most employers. When we started working with them, they were with a fully insured plan, one of the big names that most of us would recognize, and spending about $1.2 million a year on benefits. And we had a very thoughtful conversation with their leadership about what it would mean to enter into a self-funded plan. And that very first year that we converted to them to a self-funded plan, this would have been about 6 years ago, it was about $250,000 for the savings. And like you'd mentioned, there's trends, right, that occurs. We had kind of watched our move to self-funded, which had a very positive return the very first year. And we watched medical trends continue to kind of increase and prescription trends continue to increase. And so again, going back to it being a nonprofit, right? Budget is a big concern. So as that trend continued to increase, we were looking for ways to ultimately make sure that we weren't going to necessarily cost shift to employees. Horizon Goodwill is a very employee and community oriented employer. It's incredibly important. It's a foundation of what they do to make sure that we're providing affordable and accessible healthcare. And so it wasn't an option to say, let's raise deductibles and let's raise co-pays and let's raise employee contributions. So what else was out there? And I'm sure Dave will have a further conversation with it, but we looked at alternative means. We kind of fast forward to 2020. We implemented things like reference-based pricing. We carved out the PBM. As of this recent year, we introduced direct primary care with local primary care providers. And so we've gone full circle. Horizon Goodwill has totally adopted the local mentality and implemented all five steps. And we'll get into some more stories and what Kayla will tell you. She's been here during those times to see how that's played out. But yeah, it's been an awesome journey, but it comes with its reward and spoils.
Kayla, why don't you add a little bit? And, you know, as we talked about before we went live in the prep, I was saying, you know, like any great accomplishment in life, there's always bumps along the way. So these webinars aren't all about, you know, unicorns and rainbows and fuzzy teddy bears, right? We love to hear some of the challenges along the way and some of the situation and, you know, how you work through that. So just so everybody knows, that's, you know, pull no punches, right? Tell us how it went, and we look forward to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you, Dave. And thanks, Ben. Great intro there. Pretty much, like you said, the most important thing to us was the employees and how it impacted them as the members of the plan. So we're fortunate enough to keep premiums very low for an individual employee, and then also deductibles incredibly low too. So we make it as easy as possible at the lowest cost, moving from a traditional carrier to being self-funded. We're able to get what we want at a price that we want it, and what is going to impact and benefit our members the most. Prior to coming onto Horizon Goodwill, I had never heard of a self-funded plan, but as I worked with Ben and his team over EBS, I love it. And I'm just very happy to be able to talk about some of these bumps and challenges, but ultimately how we're able to provide this wonderful benefit to our employees.
Great. Yeah, maybe, you know, it'd be good to kind of expand a little bit on, you know, I think of it as change management. Actually, in my last book, the biggest chapter in that book is on change management, right? Because this is, talk about a human enterprise, right? This is very human. And, you know, generally there's, you know, the story in healthcare has been, you know, when it comes to health benefits every year, great news, pay more, get less, right? That's been the story. So it's not exactly coming from a place of high confidence and trust. And, you know, and I know personally, you know, having a card that's not a fancy national logo, sometimes that can cause people concerns. I mean, some people like, gosh, well, can I actually get care? You know? And so talk me through a little bit, like, how has that discussion been internally, you know, both with your leadership and, you know, maybe a little bit with the employees, like, how do they understand what's going on? Because it might not be what they're used to. And, you know, we're not at our best when there's health issues going on. And so it's understandable people might have concerns.
Oh, absolutely. For us, it was definitely started with everyone at the leadership table. So, you know, this isn't a decision that I make on my own or, you know, Ben and I talk together and then we just deploy it out. We have multiple seats at the table. Our CEO, our chief business officer, our chief mission officer, we're all included in these meetings and discussing the impact it'll have on the organization financially, as well as how it's going to impact the members. And then once we decide how we're going to move forward, then comes the conversation of how are we going to educate? Because a lot of people don't understand benefits and they're confusing. So once we started making these changes and dropping the larger insurance companies and moving to being self-funded, we started having mandatory enrollment meetings. And our HR department, along with EBS, was very involved in those meetings and breaking down what benefits were. So people understood, yeah, I pay a premium, I have a health insurance card, I go to the doctor, and then I might get a bill in the mail, right? We broke it down. What do those bills mean? What are you getting for the money that you're paying? And answering everything that was in their benefit plan description. So any questions that we had, we were fully transparent in what the plan design was, how we came to our decisions, and really outlining the benefit to the member.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll just make a side note. I've seen some people put some questions into the chat box. We do have the Q&A piece, so that's where you should put in questions, and we will be curating questions later out of what people are asking. And so again, thanks for that background. Why don't we get into the optimized planned infrastructure? And again, a bit of this may predate Michaela, and you know, Ben, you could describe maybe how your working relationship, you know, is it the same as what it was when they were, you know, in a carrier controlled plan versus an employer designed plan, and how you worked with them? Has that changed at all over the last several years?
It has, for sure. I think most people understand when you purchase a fully insured contract, it more or less runs on autopilot. You visit it once a year. It's a tough conversation most times than not. And that's, you put it to bed, you don't revisit another for another 9 months. You know, it takes a lot of education. Sitting down with every person that Michaela had mentioned as a part of that that meeting, walking through what it means to have a spec deductible, walking through what it means when someone has cancer and how you mitigate that risk. It's an ongoing conversation that really hasn't stopped. I think what's kind of been the cool thing to see is when an employer starts to understand and get it, you start to see questions that pop up in the meeting that truly kind of portray that they grasp the concept, and you see how they've kind of taken it upon themselves to really make sure they're thinking about the plan in the most logical way possible. Like, how do we mitigate cost? How do we provide a possible benefit? How do we avoid certain hiccups that we see coming down the line? And so it's, when we first moved from a fully insured plan to self-funded, like one of the first things we did is said, hey, this is how we get compensated. It's a percentage of the premium. We're going to change it to a fixed per employee per month perspective, and we'll sit on the same time of the table that you guys are. Where in essence, we're not going to necessarily compensate ourselves based on how much a premium goes up or goes down, but we'll compensate how we operate based on the amount of lives that exist on the plan. And so it's a very liberating conversation when you can sit down and you talk about plan infrastructure and you talk about the plan design, and you can go through each individual line of how their costs break down. This is our cost. This is a TPA cost. This is stop loss premiums. This is claims. It makes it an easier relationship when you have that much transparency and you optimize the plan design and people can see how we structure a plan and the reason we do those things.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting having, you know, I've been in healthcare a long time, but not in health benefits, and coming in and realizing as I started to realize that health IT and health tech was entrenching status quo, it wasn't changing status quo. And then unpacking how people worked here, and it's like, oh, wow, this is weird. Like, the worse job you do, the better you get paid, at least in the smaller plans on commission. Like, that's pretty bizarre. And then that the typical broker is representing themselves as representing the buyer, but they're paid by the seller. Like, you know, that's guaranteed to have conflicts of interest, even if it's not the intent, right? I mean, there's good people doing that. And so those are the type of things where you just like, for the fresh set of eyes, like, well, that doesn't make sense. And as you said, it's really liberating. And the, you know, the thing that I think is interesting, you talk about like the set it and forget it, you know, sort of for a year. It's a disconnect with every CEO I've ever talked to has said, our most valuable asset is our employees. And, you know, often health benefits are the second biggest cost. So why wouldn't you be, you know, you worry about sales, you worry about supply chain, you worry about finance all year long. Why wouldn't you want to steward that asset carefully? You know, and I just, you know, and it's interesting, the sometimes people will introduce me as a disruptor. I'm like, no, not a disruptor. I'm a restorer. Like, the disruptor is the status quo. Disruption is, you know, being the undisputed world leaders in medical bill driven bankruptcy. And 70% of those people had insurance. I don't think you can call it insurance. Maybe from your perspective, Michaela, in terms of how you worked with brokers in the past, maybe versus, you know, and you worked with the carrier controlled plans before versus kind of the employer optimized plans, how is the relationship been with Ben versus what you had experienced before?
So before, I was simply a member on a plan. Our companies, it kind of came like from the top and you got that card. So there wasn't a lot in between. Even in our HR department, there wasn't a lot of conversations, you know, with the broker from those of us that were going to deploy and answer questions on the front line, so to speak. So this relationship dynamic was new to me, but definitely value, because we're able to have those conversations. As you mentioned, you know your employees. So as we're meeting with our employees and understanding what's going on from a benefit standpoint, we can then craft conversations all year long with Ben and his team to figure out, okay, we know this is coming down the line. How can we head this off from a financial and benefit perspective? Yeah. So, you know, those conversations, again, they happen all year. We just recently sent out a survey. You know, so we're sending out different communications where that education piece happens all year long too, especially with a new program or a new initiative has been added to the plan. We want to ensure that everyone is aware of it and understands how it works and how it benefits them by utilizing it.
Great. Great. Well, let's move to the C, the carve out PBM. Like, here is this arcane category that the average person's never heard of. I certainly hadn't heard of. And it was kind of amazing. Like, when I dug in, I was like, oh my gosh, like, there is actually not one pure pharma company in the Fortune 50. J&J is the only company that's, you know, but they have a bunch of other lines of business. It's, I think they're number 37. Yet the big three PBMs are all Fortune 50 companies. Like, it's amazing. And, you know, one of them is known as a big retailer. And prior to a merger, they had $185 billion in revenue, and $120 billion of that was in PBM. I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. And, you know, there's certainly, you know, one of the chapters I have in my first book is about how in the real market, costs haven't gone up in healthcare, you know, in nearly a decade. The one exception is specialty drugs, but otherwise, again, nurses, doctors, if supplies haven't fundamentally changed, but, you know, the industry's been terrific at putting forth this myth of trend, right? Like that's some, like, the tides or something, versus actually what's going on. And we found up to, I think, 32 different revenue streams that PBMs have created for themselves. I think most employers think there's maybe one or two that they have. So maybe talk a little bit about, how have you changed how drugs are procured? I mean, this is a very defined thing, right? There's a lot of gray area on medical stuff, but a drug is a drug is a drug, particularly in generics.
We watched within 1 year, Horizon Goodwill's pharmacy PEPM go from 120 per month to 180. It's a huge jump. Mostly red. Yes, it's huge. And we're like, oh boy, here we go, right? And everyone hears about specialty medications, and that certainly wasn't the case. We put in a pretty aggressive approach. We replaced one of those big name PBMs that most people would be familiar with an independent PBM that, quite frankly, structured the contract where it was completely flexible in terms of the formulary. We could dictate which drugs were covered and which were not. That was very important as we kind of looked towards things like patient assistance programs, which I'll touch on. But we looked at making sure that how that PBM was compensated was solely off an administrative charge. We wanted to make sure that rebates were going to pass through completely to us. There wasn't going to be any spread pricing. We wanted to try to remove as much waste as absolutely possible to make sure that the drugs, so the price we're paying for from a PBM contract, were actually the price of the drug the pharmacy was keeping. And we're fortunate to an extent. In addition to kind of changing the PBM, we introduced international prescription sourcing, which we've had some great success with. And I think our largest success was leveraging patient assistance programs or manufacturer's assistance programs that come directly from pharmaceutical manufacturers. And the top five specialty medications that showed up for that year, and medications that most of us would see advertised on TV, we were fortunate to the end that most of those employees qualified from an income perspective based on kind of the type of population that Horizon Goodwill has. And so we set out with a new PBM, decided how certain drugs were going to be covered. And in the case where we could identify a high-cost specialty medication, we carved that drug off the formulary and were able to connect that member directly to the pharmaceutical manufacturer, where they receive that drug at absolutely no cost. Horizon Goodwill didn't incur a cost of that specialty medication, and ultimately we uncoupled that member's access to the medication from their employer, which in terms of being life-saving or life-altering medication, that's a comfort factor to an employee that if layoffs were to occur, which happened this year, they wouldn't necessarily think about having access to that medication solely through their employer's health plan. And so we were able to basically go from 120 to 180 back down to 136 in 1 year with those mitigation tactics.
Yeah. One of the things that people aren't, there's actually a couple things that are notable that a lot of people aren't aware of. On the drug side, there was this Medicare Modernization Act bill that happened during the George W. Bush administration. It included the most amazing accomplishment ever in the history of lobbying, that it prevented the government from negotiating drug prices. Unbelievable. Like, man, that in the Hall of Fame of lobbyists are the pharma lobbyists on that. But there was one thing on the other side of that, which is what Ben alluded to. There was these patient access programs. And I think it's up to like 400% of federal poverty line, which, you know, you could have a six-figure income, right? Particularly if you have a family, and be eligible for free medications, right? Because that was part of the deal, that was a little bit of the give back on this amazing, you know, giveaway to the industry. And so you can get these very expensive medications basically for no cost if you deploy some of these types of tactics. The other thing, kind of related not to pharmacy, but also generally people aren't aware of, that's a similar thing. In the Affordable Care Act, there's a clause 501R that's kind of a corollary in the hospital area. So if you're a tax-exempt hospital, you have to have a financial assistance program. And kind of similar, you're 300% of the federal poverty line, you have to basically, care has to be provided for free. In a lot of these, I mean, it's published on their site. That's a whole other discussion. But again, there are things for lower, you know, really even not that low of income people that a lot of, you know, if you just do set it and forget it, the carrier controlled plan, you don't have somebody working hard like Ben, you won't take advantage of that. But those programs are out there. You know, let's move on. You know, I know you started a different primary care approach. It'd be interested to hear a little of the backdrop on that. And, you know, that's the A, add value-based primary care, you know, as opposed to volume-centric primary care that unfortunately has really led to record levels of burnout and even suicide amongst primary care docs. It's awful. You know, the number one driver is them having to deal with insurance. A typical doc is spending 2 hours on administration for every 1 hour of patient care, if you can believe that. Proper primary care gets rid of that. Let the doctors be doctors is sort of the summation of that. But what was the backdrop on that? I'm kind of curious, did Michaela drive that? Did Ben, did you bring that to her? Where was that all going?
Yeah, we moved a reference-based pricing plan. And like most employers in a certain geographical region, there's some overarching hospital systems that make dealing with RVP plans pretty complicated. And for even routine-based services, going in for primary care and navigating with a hospital-owned primary care practice, it's challenging. And so we looked at some of the access issues that were occurring and said, hey, is there an opportunity to maybe, number one, make it more accessible by providing primary care outside of the normal hospital system that exists for most employees? And so we got in touch with a local direct primary care provider. There was one literally a couple miles away from Horizon Goodwill's headquarters. Fortunately, he was someone who's been an early adopter of DPC, more than 10 years. And he, through kind of collaborating together, Horizon Goodwill's got a pretty big footprint. They are in 19 counties and 4 states. And Michaela, keep me honest if I misquoted that. But we basically got on the phone with other direct primary care providers that were in West Virginia, that were in Virginia, that were in Pennsylvania, in Maryland. And we said, hey, we have a population that needs access to primary care, and this is what we're willing to do for that. And so it really was born out of two things. One, the idea that if we can make primary care more accessible and not have to deal with the the burden of trying to run into RBP and the complications with that. And then ultimately, Horizon Goodwill, based on some of the savings we were having, made an investment in direct primary care, where the DPC membership is 100% funded by the organization for all employees and families. And so I'll let Michaela kind of speak to it as well. She's the HR and a patient of one of the DPC providers. So Michaela?
Yeah. So talking about those bumps, challenges, and pain points, that switch from going reference-based pricing, definitely we had a large population served by a hospital network, and they were very difficult to work with. They would tell our members that they wouldn't participate. Oh, you're self-pay. You have to pay today. We're not going to take this card. We're not even going to call them. We won't submit your claims. And it was very hard just to get general, you know, if my son needed to be seen for his wellness visit. It was just round and round in circles because they didn't understand the insurance and they felt like it wasn't their job in the billing office to understand it. So when Ben presented this idea, you know, I was all on board because, you know, I was a member within one of those networks that we were just having a hard time with the hospital billing system to get on board with the reference-based pricing. So we made the switch and offered the DPC, and I was one of the first individuals to sign up for it. And it really changed how I interact with my primary care. So, you know, I wasn't able to like talk to my primary care doctor before just through a text message or an app. Like I had to schedule an appointment and then I had to have this virtual meeting and all these other things had to happen, where now I can just send a quick message and say, hey, my son has this rash. Do I have to be concerned? No, it's pretty, you know, simple. Just go ahead and pick up this cream at the pharmacy. Let me know if it gets worse though. So, you know, without having to pick everybody up, drive to a facility, wait in line, potentially be exposed to other things in the community, right? From other people coming into the facility for something that I'm being seen for is very minor. And then having to wait in line at the pharmacy, and it has removed all of those barriers. So I can't say enough good things about the DPC program. And I still love the reference-based pricing. And when I do need additional care, I can fall back on that and know that I can go wherever I need to go or want to go to be seen and know that I'll be taken care of as well and still have the benefit of our health plan behind it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that's nice that's not obvious about a lot of the direct primary care docs is a fair number of their patients are self-insured, uninsured, and so they tend to know who are high quality care providers, not just from a healthcare delivery perspective, obviously, which is first and foremost, but also who won't abuse patients. And that makes a difference, right? And there are a lot of folks who do direct contracts and, you know, Pacific Steel, who I mentioned earlier, you know, they, I think last count, they have 5,500 direct contracts that RBP ends up being kind of a de facto out of network solution. But as long as it's non-emergent, they're like calling it, hey, Bob needs a rotator cuff thing. We'd like to have him use your facility. And that's where the either the doc or the care navigator can help. You know, we'd like to, you know, we have a simple contract. Oh, send it over, two page, lays it out, fair to both sides, addresses issues providers have. And it's quite straightforward. So that's great to hear. It's working that way.
To piggyback off of that.
Yeah.
It's been awesome to see a provider that understands costs and how certain things are paid for. In most cases, a typical fee for service primary care provider doesn't necessarily have to think about costs, right? Because they sign up to an insurance contract. It exists out there for walls. You can see our DPC providers actively referring to places, as you mentioned, whether it be something as simple as labs, x-rays, advanced imaging, where they've built relationships with independent imaging facilities, or they called up Quest or Health Networks or LabCorp and said, hey, what can we do as a provider for cash pay pricing? And so you can actively see a primary care provider with what we're working with be a steward for the health plan's money and for the patient's money. And that's not something we typically see in a fee-for-service primary care provider who typically deals with an insurance network. it's been awesome to kind of watch that happen.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly forward-looking docs recognize this concept that, you know, it's kind of a wonky medical look at it, but they call it financial toxicity. And the idea is just like you could have toxic water, toxic air, or toxic substance in your body. The fact is, if you prescribe some care plan or some medication that the member can't afford, even close to afford or execute on that plan, it's pointless. And so you're just, it's actually in some ways making things worse for the patient. And again, a forward-looking organization recognizes that. And that's why they do exactly what you said. They find the great organizations that are willing to work with them. And it makes a huge difference. So want to be mindful of time. So maybe just wrap up with, if you have maybe just one piece of advice and maybe one member story, maybe one of you can take each kind of one member story. Like at the end of the day, this comes down and you shared your own personal story, but are there any member stories of how things have been better? I mean, I've heard stories of, you know, people being able to take, you know, employee at a, you know, convenience store, being able to take a vacation for the first time in their entire marriage when they had kids because they no longer have out of cost for some expensive medication. So some of those human stories really stick. So maybe one piece of advice and one member story, if you could each, you know, share one of those.
Oh, you want me to go first?
Sure.
So the member stories are a lot easier for me, but we do have members who previously they weren't getting primary care at all. And now it's just more accessible to them that they don't have to drive to an office. We do have one individual who was really pleased with their first visit with the DPC. And also with the reference-based pricing, they were able to find care closer to home. So rather than having to drive, you know, to Baltimore to a big clinic for this specialized care, they were able to get that closer. And working with the DPC, they didn't have to get referred out for specialists. So that was something that was really great for the member, because in addition to not only the cost of the benefit that the member has to pay, you have to think about the travel to the facilities where the network is that they have to go to as well. So sometimes it doesn't equate properly to being a benefit if they have to drive further just to get seen for a specialized issue. And with the DPC program, as Ben alluded to as well, it's more in-house. With the DPC provider, the doctors are more knowledgeable. For women's care, you don't have to go to a separate doctor just to get a prescription because you're a female. You have to go see a OBGYN or something. The doctors within these primary care, it's truly about primary care. So it's your overall general health and not having to just keep referring you to specialist after specialist, which I found was happening a lot, even for my family in our healthcare. It seemed like all of us had a specialist for something. And it was hard. It was hard to juggle that as a family with your workload and things like that. So that's really a benefit that a lot of our members have noticed with the DPC and the reference-based pricing is they can be closer to home to receive their services or in their house to receive services through the app that is provided.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I've talked to a lot of docs and we've seen this now more during, especially the start of COVID, that they regularly say, you know, 2/3 of the time, you don't need to come in. We just force you to come in because that's the only way we get paid. So, or that's our old habit, like who can blame them? But once you remove that distortion, you know, most of the time they don't need to lay hands on. And so that's one of the nice things about direct primary care. So Ben, why don't you wrap it up with maybe one piece of advice that you would give folks, you know, I mean.
Over communicate, don't sugarcoat. Dave, to your point, when we first came across reference-based pricing years ago, it at the time was the silver bullet to solving healthcare. And it was, thankfully, Horizon Goodwill was not our first client that went reference-based pricing. Dave, we'd actually did another webinar with our first client that was, and they had many war stories because quite candidly, you don't know until you know. And as much as you try to prepare yourself for some things, there's things that you're not necessarily sure of. You don't understand what kind of balance billing issues you could run into or access issues. And so if I'm in my position and you're an employer, ask questions that are going to be hard questions. Think of things that you may not think of in other aspects, because in the best setting possible, it's your job to know really what can come down the line. To Dave's point, when you've entered into a contract, you're not really sure how it could happen. The blowback is real. It's severe in some cases. And if you're not prepared for those things, it can really turn your employee benefits program completely upside down.
Yep. No, great advice. So we're going to get into Q&A, but there was some of the Q&A actually already came in, kind of relates to what I'm going to go through here briefly, which is two things. One, we have a new employer program. And then also once a year, we invite some advisors into applying to the process. The process that Ben went through, about 15 to 18% of folks make it through that process. And I'll show that, but let's start with the employer program. And so it's sort of like the advisor program that we've had, just to help employers who are maybe different points of the journey. Maybe they're starting on the journey. Maybe they're in it. They want to have community and education. We have a number of things in this that are outlined here. We'll send a follow-up link with more details on the employer program, but there's a community there. There's employer roundtables. They have office hours with us. There's a bunch of resources they can tap into and kind of get a high-level second opinion on their plan, those types of things. It's typically employers in the kind of 50 to 5,000 employee range that's the best fit for. They're in a decision-making role. It's $99 a month. There's no long-term commitment. You want to be on it for 3 months, hop off, that's fine. And so we're just kind of in a early rollout of this. So if you are interested, go to healthrosetta.org/employers to learn more. And you can sign up if you have interest on that. So that's something new that we did, just because there was a lot of interest in some additional education. Because, you know, again, a lot of people just, whenever they got their card, paid a lot of money and didn't think about it. Now they want to be more informed. So that's what we designed that program for. And then the benefits advisor program, as I mentioned, we are taking applications through the end of May for that. It is all about community of aligned advisors that want to really and are driving the shifts in the marketplace. There's a lot of education, a lot of community growth. There's access to technology and services that are not broadly available. And so if you want to get more information, there's a link here. We'll put that in the follow-up email and maybe in the chat box. It may have already gone there. So with that, why don't we shift over to some Q&A? So hang on a second. My team has been curating the Q&A. So I'm going to take a look here. So there was a question around, was Horizon able to get a lower multiple of Medicare rates from a non-BUCA TPA, or does this require direct contracts or centers of excellence? So maybe this is maybe a question for Ben.
Yeah, we two types of RBP, right? Litigation and negotiation. Litigation, in more cases, most cases, provides a pretty poor member experience, even though it maximizes cost savings. We went with an approach that was more the negotiation style. We started the majority of our payments at 140% with the stop loss contract ability to go up to 200% with negotiation.
Yeah. Okay, good. Next question is around, when I'm given current PEPM rates, I'd like to compare to a realistic target. What would that be? And what's a good number to share with a client, how much they can really be paying per member? And there's some nuance on that, right? People have to be careful on comparing apples to apples, you know, because you know, one of the more deaf thing that carriers do will say, you know, premiums only went up 10%, which is still a tremendous amount of money, but then often, you know, cost sharing and deductibles, you know, co-insurance, network access, all kinds of other things will change. And so, I don't know, Ben, if you have a rule of thumb there. I mean, we've done a lot of different webinars where we break that out. I think in the case of the Pacific Steel example, which has been doing it longer and is quite, you know, well developed, I think Trend had them at $1,100 PEPM, and they're at, I think, $446. So they, you know, pretty radically different. So, you know, that's something where it's hard to give a super precise answer. I mean, we know what Milliman has as far as, you know, family of four premiums and all that. and so that's typically when we get involved in a plan, our team specifically will work with the advisor and understand the coverage, understand, you know, our family members involved or not, and all those kinds of things, and really do a deep dive, you know, and look at things like, you know, do they have a typical population, or is this a, you know, population of super healthy or super unhealthy folks? You know, obviously a trucking company, you know, that's got a lot of truckers, right? That are, you know, maybe middle age or above and not necessarily living the healthiest lifestyle is going to be quite different than another one. So I don't know, if, Ben, if you want to add anything to that, but that's kind of my take on it.
It's all relevant to peer group, industry, size, and where you are in the country.
Yeah.
Outside of those three things, it's really tough to put a benchmark to something.
Yeah. All right. So the next question is, you're talking about the patient assistance programs for the medications. And the question is that run through an outside company, a PBM? Does a group charge PEPM or a percentage savings? Kind of what are the mechanics of how that actually happens?
Yeah, we work with a third party to help facilitate that, a patient advocate. Those manufacturer assistance programs applications are not a walk in the park. It requires a lot of coordination, a lot of effort, collecting tax information from the employee, coordinating with the doctor. So our approach to it was we used a patient advocate, and then it was a percentage of savings.
Okay, great.
Yep.
I don't know if this is an issue that you contend with, but there's a question around kind of drug and alcohol rehabilitation. You know, there's some really high cost rehab centers. There's a lot of different approaches to that. Have you come across that as an issue, you know, with the workforce you've had to tackle, or maybe other clients?
It's definitely present, right? We've seen spikes in mental health utilization more recently with everything that's going on. To some extent, as I think that question to kind of point out, a lot of these are very high cost out of network to some extent. Our ability to help contain that cost is definitely helpful with reference-based pricing, our ability to negotiate with those things. It provides access wherever you need to go, but in the sense that we have the ability to help dictate that cost and help negotiate to it, it definitely helps us mitigate as much of that cost as possible.
Yeah,
and to piggyback off of that, if there's issues in our workforce where they might be seeking that type of service, we also lean on our EAP program for that initial contact if they do need that, and utilize those free resources first. So they'll always advocate as well for the employee into a program that's financially suitable to them too, in conjunction with the benefit plan.
Yeah, there's a question from another HR director around the greatest transition moving to RBP. You know, and moving away from a traditional, you know, enormous carrier plan. And I think that the piece of advice that Ben had at the end is probably one of the biggest things. It's communication. And Michaela mentioned some of what they did and explaining how things worked. We had at one of our summits, one of our advisors, Bryce Heinbaugh, went through kind of a simulated employee education session. So Doug, who asked that question, you know, contact us. We can send you a link to that session if you want, because it was how Bryce communicates with a working class workforce, and communication's a big part of it, getting ahead of it. I also mentioned that sometimes it's DPC. In the case of Pacific Steel, they have an internal kind of member advocate, kind of concierge role. So if it's not emergent, you know, that person is just there to help them. And they will get, generally, it's always a lot easier if before the member ever shows up, you know, with a card that might not be familiar, is that there's already been a conversation, hopefully already an agreement, or the RBP vendor has already handled that. That's personally what I think is most impactful, is that's all addressed before the member has to step into the work. It's awkward. They show up at the counter and there's, you know, a $12 an hour, you know, clerk that's basically been put in a box to say no to everything that doesn't look like them, you know, something they've seen, you know, before. So I don't know, Michaela or Ben, you want to add anything additional to what you've already said, but those would be kind of a couple of top line thoughts.
Yeah, one of the things that we employed when we switched to reference-based pricing was utilizing HealthJoy as a concierge service for our members. So if they have any questions about where they can find a provider or a facility, they can open up the HealthJoy app, or they can call in and get personalized direction on where to get care. It also has a like telemedicine feature too, so they can call in and rather than using a primary care, they can get service through the phone too, through the on-call doctors. They help with the balanced billing. I think without HealthJoy, we really would have struggled even more than we did with the change over to reference-based pricing. But they, once we learned to lean on them, it became a lot easier for us in educating employees and where to point them for help with balanced bills and things of that nature, to make sure they removed us from interacting directly as a member with billing offices and doctors. Because once we called HealthJoy, they started calling the facilities for us and dealing with the billing. We no longer had to be involved with the headache. And we were encouraged to make sure, you know, don't pay anything until after you've contacted HealthJoy and got the bill resolved.
Yeah, great. Terrific. Well, we are up on the time. There have been some questions that, you know, about how we define things like value-based primary care and some of the other things that, you know, are coming from folks that, which is great. They obviously are not that familiar with Health Rosetta, and I'm glad they're on the call, but we're very open source about what we do. So you go to healthrosetta.org. There's a lot of resources there where we define the components. You can, you know, front and center, there's like, get a book, get the books. You can download all the books for free, including an executive summary of them. You know, want to go buy a hard copy, feel free. We define these things. We have tons of case studies. The most recent book is The Relocalizing Health, and it kind of each one kind of builds on the other. So I would tend to steer you there. And then you can always go back and reference it. And like I said, if you want to buy it, that's fine. But we just want to get the word out there. It's so important. You know, in the first book, The CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream, I had a rather provocative chapter entitled, We've Gone to War for Less Than What Healthcare Has Done to America, and outlines that. So most of our focus is on the positive, how to address that, but there's real consequence to sticking with the status quo. And so, yeah, go to those sites. We have the employer program. We've got the advisor program where it's applicable. We actually have a lot of career switchers that have become advisors. I mean, the last cohort, we had a doctor, we had a hospital CEO, we had a PT, we had a former White House policy advisor, we have some tech consultants. So there's people who've made the shift, you know, from within the profession, but then there's people from outside because they realize this is probably the biggest lever in the entire industry. I wrote a piece in Forbes called "This Job Could Save America," referring to benefits professionals. And so it's really very impactful if you take advantage of that opportunity. So again, want to thank Michaela and Ben and all your efforts and the team for making it happen. Look forward to continuing to hear updates, particularly since DPC is relatively new. And for anybody else, get plugged in. We have more of these webinars, lots of resources, summits, you name it. We love to have a big, broad, open tent for everybody. So hope you have a great rest of your Friday and a terrific weekend, and look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
You.
See you.